This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Whose job is it to make sure that convicted criminals learn from their mistakes and stay out of trouble? Whoever it is, they're not doing well. The most recent statistics show that nearly two-thirds of convicts will be rearrested after they're released, and of those, almost half will return to prison for committing a new crime. Now, wait a minute, you say. After all of the recent cutbacks in rehabilitation programs and drug treatment, what can you expect? Well, the depressing fact is that recidivism rates have held more or less steady through well-funded periods and lean for the past 40 years. Which begs the question, do these programs really work? Are some better than others? What makes a program effective? How do we tell what's working and what isn't? And whose job is it to decide what works, do it, and at least slow down the revolving door that returns convicted criminals to prison again and again? Later in the program, a look at the lessons learned from the FBI roundup of aliens after 9/11, and we'll talk to an editor in London whose newspaper is publishing remembrances of the dead from all sides in the Iraq War. But first, part two in our series on law and order. We'll look at the types of programs that try to keep cons on the straight and narrow, and we'll ask whether prison wardens should be held accountable for recidivism. To get in on the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Alex Holsinger, an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. He's worked with several states to help them develop prison programs, and he joins us from the studios of member station KCUR in Kansas City. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
So who is responsible for recidivism rates?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that certainly is at the foremost thought processes of many different state and federal agencies. To start off with, I would say that the person or people that are most responsible for recidivism are the individuals who are going out and recommitting criminal behavior. That said, I think it's also important to understand that much of the treatment, both within our institutions and within community correctional agencies, which I hope don't get ignored in the discussion, although I realize prisons are the focus.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about what happens after prison next week on our next part of our series. So go ahead.
Certainly. That much of the treatment, or much of what is considered treatment, is treatment in name only, and does not incorporate what are the known principles of effective intervention.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bad news. I think the good news is that there is a very large body of research, and that body of research continues to grow, that has shown and continues to show the way towards what does constitute effective correctional intervention. And the trick now, although I don't want to trivialize it as a trick, but the trick now is to make certain that all correctional agencies that try to deliver rehabilitative services know and understand what these principles are,
mm-hmm.
understand how to implement them, and, as importantly, receive the resources and the funding to do so in a manner that has some integrity.
Well, we'll talk about those programs in a minute, but it's one of the criteria for judging these programs. Do they reduce recidivism?
That's certainly the fairest judge of a program's effectiveness, without question. I would like to add, though, that it's important to keep in mind and to examine whenever anyone sees a quote-unquote recidivism study, that attention gets paid to how recidivism is indeed measured, because there are a number of different ways to measure it. Oftentimes, new arrest for any crime is used because that's an easy measure to gain. It's a relatively easy to run a background check on somebody and determine whether or not they received an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a bad measure of recidivism, but it's by no means the best measure of recidivism, particularly when you take a close look at some criminal behavior and the fact that not all offenders are alike. Many have different needs. Many have different specialties, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So in answer to the first question of who's responsible, I think the answer was nobody. And
well,
the answer to the second question is, are these programs measured on whether they reduce recidivism? The answer is no.
That's, at this point, that's correct. That's correct. But again, I would caution and add that when you talk about recidivism, that there are many different ways to measure that.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick example, if I may. One program in particular, what they do is treat chronic drunk driving behavior. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's their specialty. That's what they do. And for an offender to be eligible to enter into the program, they have to have had 3 DUI convictions. As such, the fairest measure of recidivism for that program then is new drunk driving behavior after release from that program.
Not shoplifting now, or something else. I'll
not shoplifting. Yeah. And I hesitate to call someone who commits an assault a success story. But by the same token, if what that program does and concentrates on is drunk driving behavior, if they didn't commit drunk driving behavior post-release, then statistically speaking, that is a success.
But on the other hand, if the reason they didn't have a chance to commit such an offense was because they were doing a 12 to 15 on some other crime, that's not exactly, you kind of have to take them out of the study, don't you think?
That's correct. Well, time at risk is something that also needs to get taken into consideration.
Okay. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Alan, who's on the road with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Right. Thanks, Neil, for taking my call. I listen to your show. It's good stuff.
Thanks.
In regards, I'm an ex-con myself. I was sentenced to prison for 1975 for possession with intent to distribute, and did a 5-year sentence. Did about 2.5 years before I was released to parole. But I remember the staff there telling me that, there is no rehabilitation in prison. If you want to really do something with your life, Alan, you're going to have to do it. Yeah, we have some programs here for you, but you can either do hard time or you can do good time. The choice is yours. And so I got busy taking care of myself and wanting to say, well, I'm not going to go back here. And I was one of the few guys that chose not to do the hard time, because there's a lot of guys in there who, in my judgment, give up and became bitter, angry and disillusioned, and of course that whole system feeds on you to reoffend, and you become more or less just part of the process, and you keep going back into prison, and you kind of give up, and you pretty soon you can't make it in the real world. And I saw that on a lot of the guys' faces. I saw them grow old in a matter of just a couple years, and the parole board says, well, we'll see you in a couple years, and you come back and try it again. And so you're resentenced not only by the court but by the parole board, and some of the guys can't take that. But my message is the rehabilitation comes from within, and the staff told me that. And I know there's programs out there that can help, but I think the man has to make a decision. Is he going to do hard time or good time? It doesn't matter if you're in prison or you're out here in the real world.
Alex Holsinger, you were saying at the beginning of our conversation that the people most responsible for recidivism were those who went out and committed new crimes.
Correct.
And in this case...
Yeah. And I was being somewhat jocular in saying that, but the caller points out a very important and I think sometimes overlooked factor, and that is that personal motivation does have a lot to do with success in treatment as well as success after release by staying out of trouble. Not all offenders are motivated to participate in treatment. Not all offenders are motivated to behave while they're within the institution, and obviously not motivated to stay out of trouble. That's not to say, however, that personal motivation is definitely something that can be targeted. And motivation can be increased. It's not necessarily easy. The caller sounds like he, through a number of different factors, although he didn't go into a lot of detail, was motivated to change his life. He looked at his surroundings, and he apparently gleaned on his own what he needed to do to stay out of trouble. He, as he admitted as well, was one of the few. He was an exception to that rule.
Mm-hmm.
But again, personal motivation is indeed a factor.
Alan, can you think of anything that would have convinced those other bitter guys you were talking about to change their minds, change their focus?
There are some guys who will probably deserve to stay there, but as far as for something that would really change it, all I can say is that, I bumped into the fact that that's where I bumped into a 12-step program. That's where I bumped into this and that, and the prison situation scared the bejesus out of me. And I had to kind of break down before I could come back up. Is there something that would trigger one man? Why one man would recognize he's got a substance abuse problem and another man won't? Why one man sees an opportunity and will trip over it and never see it? That's a good question, because the recidivism rate, there's about 10% of the population, I feel, really don't belong in prison. And there's and they might be chemically dependent or something along those lines that could be would be used to maybe help them. But there again, you know, if I wouldn't have gone through that system and had the staff say, you know, Zoff, you really don't belong here. You need to do something other than, you know, that was a key, that there was a little kindness. There was a little bit of a gift from one of the staff to say, you know, you don't belong here. You need to take care of yourself. That kind of shocked me, too. It was out of the blue like that.
How long have you been out?
I was released in 78, and I have not reoffended, had any hassle. I got into AA, and I started my own business, and I wasn't, of course, supposed to vote, and I'm not supposed to do this, that, and the other, but after being clean and sober and taking care of myself, I was now I can become part of the community, although the stigma of being ex-con does make it difficult for most guys because they come out and nobody wants to take a chance, but there's some really good men behind the walls who definitely should be given a chance. No doubt about it.
Alan, first of all, congratulations, and then thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate
it. Thank you, Alex. Keep it up.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Joining us now is Jack Cowley. He worked for nearly 30 years in the correction system in Oklahoma and was a prison warden there for 20 of those years. And good of you to join us.
Thank you. Nice being with you.
I understand you advocate holding prison wardens accountable for the recidivism rates at their facilities. Why?
Well, as Alex was saying, no one is responsible in the current system. And in order for the system to work, which means that inmates must come out of prison at least no worse than when they came in, and hopefully better, then someone certainly has to be responsible, and that person is the one that controls the environment, and that's the warden. Under current ways of operating prisons, we tend not to be responsible in our operations. In other words, we move inmates around. We are building 1,000-bed prisons, 5,000-bed prisons, which makes it virtually impossible to deal on an individual basis. So the very things that we have done, perhaps to save money, has caused really a deterioration in the hope that the system can work.
So do you suggest this because somebody has to be responsible for whether that particular prison program, a rehabilitation program or a 12-step program, whatever it is, somebody has to be responsible for saying, look, this is working and this isn't, and it's not working, let's get something else in here?
That's correct. I know that more people can leave prison and stay out than what is currently happening.
Alex Holzinger, I know you wanted to come in there.
Sure, I did. And I would like to just, first and foremost, very respectfully disagree with the idea of holding wardens personally accountable for that for a number of reasons and for many of the reasons that were just brought up. The rehabilitation and treatment of the inmates that are under a warden's supervision in very broad strokes is just one of many, many different concerns in what amounts to an extremely complex job. And the system itself and the goals of the system and the building of large prisons and other what I would call administrative issues really prevent rehabilitation, in the purest sense of the term, from being a goal first and foremost of our correctional system. Until that happens, until we make and fund and support rehabilitation and treatment programs at least the same level that we are supporting the building of new beds, I think it's unfair to hold any one person, even a warden, accountable.
We're talking about what types of prison programs might be effective to cut down on repeat offenders. And when we come back from a break, more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about ways to keep criminals from returning to prison and who should be held responsible if they do. Our guest is Alex Holsinger, an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. And also with us is Jack Cowley, who was a warden in Oklahoma for 20 years. And Jack Cowley, before we left for the break, we were talking about why you think wardens ought to be held responsible in some ways, accountable. As Alex Holsinger has said, there's an awful lot more, you certainly know better than I, that goes into the warden's job than just monitoring this. I mean, you're held accountable for a zillion things. Why one more?
Well, because that's the job. I mean, that's what the warden does. That's what the public pays him for, is not only to protect them while those violent inmates are there. And let me say that 45% of the people in prison are nonviolent offenders. And that's what the warden is supposed to do. You know, those who can do and those who can't teach.
Hmm.
It's the way you look at the job. And quite honestly, we in corrections, and I love the profession dearly, I loved every day that I went to work, but we have convinced the public that because of the type of offenders that we have, the people that we keep, that we have riots, that we have killings, that we have an impossible situation with which to deal, and therefore can only be responsible for maintaining some control. And few wardens, as a matter of fact, are ever disciplined in the event of riots. So it's a wonderful position because you really don't have to be held responsible for a lot. And quite frankly, if wardens were held responsible, you would see the system change dramatically overnight. All we would have to do is put on the warden's annual evaluation that recidivism drops 10 to 15%. And you would see drastic changes.
Well, let's get a listener involved. And Alex?
Actually, I would again disagree. I would say that rather than seeing massive change, you would see wardens change like basketball coaches. The change needs to occur at a much higher level, at a legislative level.
Well, if they change like basketball coaches, what's the problem with that as long as you get somebody
right.
who wins?
And I can tell you that wardens are in every judicial district almost of the state, and legislators will listen when wardens begin to talk. I guarantee you.
I think that, the energy needs to go into taking a look more at the programs that are being housed inside the prisons. And if you wouldn't want to hold the wardens responsible for making the decisions about which programs and which vendors that they choose to help get contracts to deliver services within the institution, that's absolutely fine, and that should be part of the assessment of a warden. But ultimately, the warden is not there as an individual professional to change offenders on an individual level. The warden is there to administrate a prison. At least that's the model that I and most everyone I know operate under.
Well, that's why they're called penitentiaries, because they were designed to change people that came into them. And wardens set the tone. Wardens set the environment. And anyone in prison can tell you that the warden is the one that makes the decision on the environment and how the rest of the staff deal with the offenders.
Well, let's get Joseph involved here. He's on the line with us from somewhere around Sacramento in California.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am inclined to agree with most of what is being said. To be sure, I would say that until prisons have a baseline educational program that put inmates and parolees out into the environment with a piece of paper that verifies that they have a basic education, we're not going to get much momentum going. But I would tell you that regardless of what you provide to the inmate, until that inmate makes a decision in and of themselves, for themselves, to stop the mechanism that got them there, they will always come back to prison. And I say that because I've managed to go to prison twice in my 50 years. And The first time federal penitentiary, the second time state prison, for completely different reasons. But he was breaking that mechanism and making that personal contract with myself. I literally said out loud, the first and most important thing in my life is the air that I breathe. And the second most important thing in my life is my freedom. That allowed me to break the cycle, if you will, to smash somebody's nose when I got angry. It was a problem before. To manage my anger, to manage my life better, to not having done a drug in over 10 years, things of this nature, regardless of my education, allowed me to stay free. And I might add that of the 16 of us that reported to the parole office in downtown San Jose 8 years ago, I am the only one that has not reviolated.
Hmm. When you were inside, Joseph, did you get the feeling in either of the prisons that you were in that the warden had a stake in your success?
No. There's too much bureaucracy involved. There's too much politics involved. And I got myself involved at Folsom State Prison in the ABE program, the Adult Basic Education Program. And the warden is a very busy man, but I never sensed necessarily that he was particularly interested in my success on a very basal level. I got in there because I have a good education, and you'd be surprised. But when I got in there, and I had a classroom of 40 inmates, none of which could read a word, and I started reading to them some of the classics from Shakespeare to any that you could think of, and I'd get my tone going, and I'd get them interested. I'd get them then reading along with me and forming the words. The point is that when I left, there was 17 high school graduates that I was directly responsible for, and every one of them was doing life without parole. The others that didn't get their diploma were going back out anywhere from 1 to 5 years after I left, and they didn't care because they knew they were going back to the environment that they were busted in. They have a sense of apathy about that environment, and it carries over, oh, well, I'll just go back to prison.
Well, Joseph, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
And Jack Cowley, we appreciate your time as well. It was good of you to join us.
Thank you.
Jack Cowley was an Oklahoma prison warden for 20 years and is a proponent of the idea that wardens be held accountable for recidivism rates in their prisons. And still with us is Alex Holsinger, who's a professor of criminal justice at the University of Missouri. He's with us from KCUR, our station in Kansas City. And we'd also like to welcome another guest. Joining us now from his office in Jefferson City is George Lombardi, director of the Division of Adult Institutions at the Missouri Department of Corrections. All prison wardens in the state of Missouri report to him. And it's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You have a different view than Jack Cowley does about holding wardens accountable for recidivism rates in their prisons. Tell us about it.
Yes, I do. To me, that's a very simplistic approach to the issue. The more important issue is to hold wardens responsible for providing the programs that would allow for a person to make cognitive changes and actual changes in their behavior so that they can be successful on the outside. I think in that way I'm more in agreement with the professor about that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And to just simply say, well, warden, you failed because the recidivism rate of the people that left your prison was this figure as opposed to that figure. There are way too many variables and factors that determine whether a person comes back to prison or not that are way beyond the scope of the warden of an individual prison. However, I do believe that we have transitioned now in recent years from simply operating our prisons safely, which was the main concern, that we made sure that people weren't killed or hurt, either staff or offenders, to starting to think about our responsibility in operating these prisons to develop the best possible product as they go out the door that we can, so mm-hmm. that we can affect the recidivism rate.
Well, in that sense, it gets back to the question, if it's not the warden's job, who is whose job is it?
The warden's job on the recidivism issue?
Yeah.
Oh, to me, it's the entire criminal justice system.
Well, they're failing.
I take the opposite approach of it's nobody's responsibility to say it's everybody's responsibility.
And to say it's everybody's responsibility means the buck gets passed around.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think what we're seeing today, and I'll tell you, here in the state of Missouri, we've embarked on a process where we're bringing in not only the criminal justice people, but all the other state departments that have an effect on an offender's life when they leave. The Department of Mental Health, Department of Family Services, the Department of Economic Development, and we're bringing in the leadership of all those departments together to say, look, we all have a responsibility for this client as they leave the prison system, and not only the client, but the client's family, to make sure that they're successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're now embarked on a process where we're all working together to develop individual prescriptive treatment plans for every offender as they leave, and we believe that this is going to have a significant impact on the recidivism rate as time progresses. And I think that's what I mean when I say everybody's responsible. I mean it's the entire social services community, including the corrections department and including the warden.
And including the parole people and all of
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely,
sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. We have to work together on this. You can't, and that's what the problem has been. Everybody has been working with their own little box, whether it's the warden or the parole board member or the parole officer on the street or the mental health service delivery person. Everybody's working independently of one another, and there has been very little communication between all of us.
Well, Alex Holsinger, let me bring you in on that point. As opposed to just identifying it as the warden's responsibility, shouldn't recidivism in the example that Mr. Lombardi's talking about be made part of everybody's job and everybody work together and the entire goal be to reduce recidivism?
Absolutely, and I think that Mr. Lombardi brings up a very good point in Missouri and other states as well, but fortunately for someone in my position in Missouri, criminal behavior is being viewed as the complex thing that it is. There are many, many factors that are brought to bear when you talk about changing someone's behavior. One point real briefly I'd like to make is the realization or the recognition at least that criminal behavior is just that. It is behavior, and it's behavior that has been reinforced over, in many cases, 20, 30, 40 years of someone's life. The criminal justice system, and more specifically any state correctional system, only has an offender for, by comparison, in most cases, a very short period of time. Changing their behavior for good in that short time frame is an extremely tall order, and it takes the integration of all the social service agencies, as Mr. Lombardi mentioned. It takes everyone being brought to the table. It takes everyone having an understanding of where criminal behavior comes from and what it takes to change that behavior. It is indeed a systemic issue there, and that's why I sort of reared back against pointing the finger at any one particular person, or for that matter, any one particular agency.
Well, Mr. Lombardi, before we let you go, and we know you're busy, should programs in your prisons be held to this same standard? They should be judged, in other words, on whether the people who graduate from them come back to prison.
Oh, absolutely, that there should be some judgment about the efficacy of those programs by looking at recidivism, and not only by looking at recidivism, but also doing some follow-up with the offender himself or herself as to how it impacted their life when they went out there and whether it still was viable when they left. One of the key issues to me, again, and the reason why we're emphasizing working with these other agencies, is that when a person leaves prison, the follow-up with that individual as to what happened in the prison system and the continuity of what they've learned in prison is very, very important to their success on the outside. I go back to the issue of boot camp programs, which were the avant-garde thing in prison systems a few years ago, but it was found that unless there was a significant follow-up with the individuals who came out of those programs, their failure rate was exactly the same as if they never had or the same as people that never had the program in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So that transition piece is really important, and that's the focus that we're having right now.
A lot of the same questions being asked about programs like DARE in school that try to keep kids off drugs.
Right.
No measurement.
I want to go back and also agree with the offender that just spoke to you about the ex-offender about education. We now have a mandatory education legislation in Missouri so that everybody who does not have a high school diploma or a GED must be enrolled in education while they're in prison.
Hmm.
And we are now finding that those people who get their GED while they're in prison are much more successful than those who do not when they leave.
George Lombardi, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
George Lombardi is director of the Division of Adult Institutions at the Missouri Department of Corrections. All the prison wardens in that state report to him. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Alex Holsinger is still with us, and let's get another caller involved. Sue Ellen joins us from Shawnee Mission, that must be, right, in Kansas.
Yes. I'm calling because I think the community has a responsibility, and I'm with a volunteer organization called Stop Violence, and we went into the prison and asked the inmates what are some of the issues that they want to discuss and have information about. And as a result of what they told us, we brought in professionals to talk to them about child abuse, spouse abuse, sexual abuse, substance abuse, anger management, conflict resolution, forgiveness. And one of the inmates turned all of that information into a Socratic curriculum that's called Reaching Out from Within. And the inmates worked this program, and the recidivism rate for inmates who are involved in this program is 23%. And when inmates get transferred to other correctional facilities, the first thing they request of the warden is to please initiate the program there. And so the program is now spread to six correctional facilities in the state of Kansas.
Okay, let's bring Alex Holsinger in, and I'm not sure whether you're familiar with this particular program or not, but there is not only this one, there's a lot of them out there.
Indeed, yeah. And one of the things that, since the caller mentioned specifically the Socratic method and offender-run programs, there's nothing inherently wrong with using offenders to run programs. But the research tends to show that it's very important to also have outside professionals who are trained in the specific area that program is trying to treat be involved in an advisory capacity, as well as being directly involved as well.
We just have a couple of seconds left, but if there was one program that you could say, all right, let's try that, what would it be?
Well, I wouldn't pick one particular program, but rather a type of program, and that would be, without question, more resources need to be put into the cognitive behavioral curriculum. The programs that specifically address antisocial thinking, antisocial thoughts and attitudes that in turn relate to many other areas, including criminal behavior, but also drug and alcohol use and abuse and things of that nature.
Okay.
More and more the research is showing that programs that at their core have a cognitive behavioral curriculum at the heart of their programming stand a much better chance of being effective in the long term.
Alex Holsinger, thanks very much for staying with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Alex Holsinger, an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at the University of Missouri, was with us from member station KCUR in Kansas City. Next week, the third part of our Law and Order series will be about programs available to prisoners once they're released and trying to make it on the outside. On Thursday, Joe Queenan joins us to talk about his new book, True Believers, The Tragic Inner Life of Sports Fans. Coming up after the break, the DOJ and aliens. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.